Hello and welcome to the Mile End Institute podcast, coming to you from Queen Mary University of London. I'm Dr. Patrick Diamond. I'm director of the Mile End Institute. And today we're here to talk about the politics of expertise. I'm joined by two guests, Dr. Lise Butler and Dr. Agnes Arnold-Forster. Lise is a historian of modern Britain, specialising in political history, left-wing politics and the history of the social sciences. She completed her doctorate at University College Oxford in 2015, and her first book, Michael Young, Social Science and the British Left, was published by Oxford University Press. The book examines the relationship between the social sciences and left-wing politics in the decades after the Second World War. Lise, welcome to the podcast. Tell us a little bit more about what you've recently been working on.
Thanks very much for having me, Patrick. I should say I completed my doctorate at University College Oxford, different university, which is neither here nor there. I am, as you say, a historian of left-wing politics and social science. In 2020, I published a book called Michael Young, Social Science and the British Left, which looked at the relationship between left-wing politics and social science in the post-war period through the figure of the sociologist and policymaker Michael Young. More broadly, I'm interested in left-wing social movements and left-wing politics. And these days, I am looking at the history of freedom of information campaigns and their relationship to the Labour Party and progressive politics more broadly from the 70s to the 2000s.
Freedom of information. We'll come back to that hopefully a bit later in the discussion. Agnes is a writer, researcher and historian. She's researched and presented on everything from women's health in today's Britain to cancer in Victorian England, as the website says. Agnes worked previously as a research and engagement fellow, including spending a period at Queen Mary's Centre for the History of the Emotions. And she now works at the Centre for History and Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Agnes, welcome to you. And what are you working on at the moment?
Thanks so much for having me. I don't know, I feel like I have my finger in lots of pies. I'm writing a book on the history of nostalgia, which is a big, overly ambitious volume from the 17th century to the present. But I'm also working on a big Wellcome Trust funded project that looks at the place of charity in the NHS. And I suppose that's really my current, or at least has been for the time being, intellectual home, thinking about the history of the National Health Service, its developments, the development of NHS hospitals, and its sort of perpetual efforts, not always very successful efforts at reform. And also I'm very interested in, as you mentioned, I've worked as a historian of the emotions for a while now, very interested in the emotional relationship between the British public and their health service. So yeah, that's me at the moment.
Sounds great. And again, I hope we can return to talking about the National Health Service and how that relates to some of the issues around the politics of expertise. So the politics of expertise is a vast topic, but we're discussing expertise at a particular historical juncture. The 2016 Brexit referendum campaign shone a spotlight on growing conflicts over the legitimacy of expertise. Remember Michael Gove's infamous quip that people have had enough of experts. And of course, for the last 2 years, we've been living in the shadow of the COVID pandemic, where experts played a prominent role in shaping public policy and governance. Rather than dismissing experts, government ministers never tired of insisting that they were merely following the science. So there couldn't be a better time to take stock of the politics of expertise and how it relates to government and society. Let's kick off our discussion then by exploring some broad definitions of expertise. Let's start with you, Lise. Who, in your view, is an expert? And in the context of 20th century Britain, how have our notions of what and who an expert is evolved?
That's such a good question. And I'm not sure that I, as a historian, or indeed anyone, is particularly well placed to comment on who specifically is an expert. But I do think it's interesting to reflect on the changing role and place of expertise in our sort of political or political consciousness. So as any good historian would do before I sat down to record this podcast, I did a little Google Ngram on just the word expertise. And what's interesting is you see a sharp uptick in the use of the word after 1960, peaking around the 2000s. And I think that this really speaks to the rise of a more professionalized notion of expertise and indeed academic expertise emerging out of the growth of the university sector in the post-war period. So one of the things that historians of the social sciences and historians of knowledge more generally have really noted is the rapid expansion of universities in this country in the post-war period, and the ways in which certain disciplines move from becoming what the sociologist Mike Savage terms a sort of gentlemanly amateurism to becoming more sort of professionalized disciplines. So I think that throughout the post-war period in general, we have seen a kind of rapid expansion in terms of what we might call experts and a kind of more central role for what we might think of as expertise. And I think that this has had interesting ramifications on policymaking. So, for example, I think that the Blair government, the new Labour government, was very invested in a notion of evidence-based policymaking, something which has been contested from various perspectives, both before and after. But in many ways, that speaks, I think, to the rise in kind of political confidence in the notion of expertise. And as you rightly indicate, we've seen political pushback in the form of Michael Gove's famous remark that we've had just about enough from the experts. And indeed, I think the COVID pandemic has seen a really interesting reconfiguration of that, with experts flanking the prime minister on either side during many COVID briefings. So I think we're at a really interesting point where expertise is perhaps more politicized and more contested than ever before.
So Agnes, Lise just mentioned there that the politicization of expertise and its growing prominence, particularly in the context of the COVID pandemic. What about definitions of medical expertise in particular? How would you say our understandings of what and who a medical expert is have altered over the last century?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think one of the things that I also did my research before coming on this podcast, you'll be pleased to hear. And I think I found that the earliest use of expert in the kind of way that we'd be familiar with it now is sort of early 19th century. And that's not really surprising if you know anything about the kind of cultures of the 19th century. And also not that surprising if you know anything about the history of medicine and medical expertise specifically, because medicine only really managed to establish itself as something that people sort of understood as useful to, I mean, they wouldn't call it policymaking necessarily in the 19th century, but useful to the national good in the 19th century. And by the end of the 19th century, doctors were seen as sort of socially useful, politically useful, politicized individuals, but also as a sort of professional cohort. But what's interesting to me, and they were very useful, particularly in the kind of public health crises of the late 19th century and in the early 20th century, like cholera and big infectious diseases. But the thing that's interesting to me is that their position has always been slightly unstable. In some ways, we still think of, I think, the doctor as the kind of quintessential expert, right? They're sort of, they have a hugely powerful social role. They have, they're placed on a pedestal, both by society, but also by individuals. And they're often, although there's often, you know, pushback to this, but they're often taken as, you know, the kind of people that we take seriously, that we trust, that we, you know, invest a huge amount of social capital, intellectual capital in, and financial capital in. But their position has always been, I think, precarious. And almost as soon as they reached that kind of status, that kind of social status, the sort of golden age of medicine is often said to be just after the Second World War, when they were finally starting to be able to actually do something for most of their patients with the introduction of antibiotics and, you know, more invasive and more successful surgeries, like open heart surgery, for example, is often seen as the kind of apex of medicine's contributions to, you know, what they can actually do for people. But almost as soon as that happened, their status became threatened by a rising patient movement and a new politics of expertise in the post-war period that was partly driven by sort of feminist critiques of medicine, partly driven by kind of leftist critiques of medicine. This sort of the expertise of experience became increasingly powerful, the expertise of the patient, the sort of subjective, emotional, experiential expertise of someone living with the disease rather than just someone treating the disease. And you have this really well articulated by specifically by feminist thinkers in the late 60s and into the 70s, this idea that expertise can be located in lots of different places and can be kind of in conflict with each other or can work together. And I think this is sort of the sort of heart in some ways of some of the problems with expertise we've seen over the last couple of years, that the expertise of experience, the expertise of kind of clinical professionalism don't always align, and can be the source and kind of turning point of some very powerful and I think often very underappreciated and insufficiently considered tensions in the way that we talk about medicine, healthcare, science. That there are lots of different ways of understanding these things. They're often presented as objective truths, but actually, you know, as with everything in history, and this is a classic historian's line, obviously, but it's all far more complicated than we might like to think.
Indeed so. And this point about the changing politics of expertise is exactly what I'd like us to focus on for a few minutes now. So we know that, as we've just been discussing, experts to some extent have been held in growing disrepute. And I think the implication of this claim is that somehow in the past, I mean, let's say the decades immediately after the end of the Second World War, experts of various kinds occupied a relatively trusted position within British society and culture. Professional economists, we haven't talked about economists yet, were held in particularly high regard because it was believed that their expertise could help to solve contemporary public problems. Medical experts, as Agnes has just been saying, were pioneering the development of the National Health Service after 1948, apparently enjoying similar levels of legitimacy. Then it's said at some point in the late 1970s or 1980s, trust in experts begins to dissipate. There's a growing tide of scepticism and mistrust towards experts, fueled in our own times by the rise of the internet, social media, 24/7 news, and so on. Lise, is that just a historical caricature? What are the problems of understanding the changing role of expertise in that way?
I'm not sure if that's a caricature, and I think there's a lot to that frame that you've just suggested. But I think what I'm more interested in is the ways in which different forms of expertise achieve prominence or given credence by policymakers at different times. My research on Michael Young was very much focused on the role of the rise of the social sciences in British public life in the post-war period. And what was going on there, what was central there, was a sense among a certain group of left-wing policymakers who were very influenced by the rise of psychology and sociology, that economics had become too dominant. So there was a sense that the frames of policymaking, and particularly the frames by which the Attlee government oriented policymaking in the post-war period, during the period of the kind of establishment of the welfare state, the New Jerusalem, so on and so forth, had been too focused on economics. So they had focused on economics and very much on macroeconomic questions, which had privileged things like maintaining full employment. And there was a sense amongst a certain group of policymakers that that had left out questions about what made people happy, what made communities cohere, what made families stay cohesive, what made social groups get along, what made people happy in their workplaces. And so what I was tracing in my work was very much the way in which what I called in my own book, the humanistic social sciences. So social sciences like psychology, sociology, and anthropology were brought in, or at least attempted to be brought into the policymaking process by a group of sociologists. And I don't want to overstate the kind of success of that project. But what we do see in social policy, the emergence of the rise of social policy as a field of study, is an attempt to use those social sciences and those frames and apply them to the growth of the welfare state from the 50s to the 70s. And one of the things that I think is important to trace is actually the backlash to that movement in the 1980s under the Thatcher government. So one of the moves that the Thatcher government makes is it turns the Social Science Research Council into the Economic and Social Research Council, therefore sort of marginalizing the more humanistic social sciences like sociology and putting economics back at the center of the research program of that organization. And what I think this speaks to is a kind of ongoing battle, a contestation over which modes of understanding, which forms of expertise should guide policymaking. So I think it's less about whether we are seeing a decline in respect for expertise, and it's more about what forms of expertise are being privileged by those in power and what forms of expertise are being allowed to shape and guide the decisions that are made by policymakers.
Indeed, and let's, Agnes, perhaps spend a few minutes looking at this in relation to the history of patient skepticism around expertise in healthcare. I mean, as you were saying a few moments ago, it seems that by the late 1960s, early 1970s, there's a growing literature emerging, which is more explicitly theorizing the relationship between expertise and inequality, particularly relating to class, gender, and race. And this is making more explicit the relationship between power and expertise. How much impact do these critiques actually have on the way that medicine is practiced in Britain?
Oh, it's a very good question, one that I'm still personally puzzling through, but I think that it has a huge impact, but for a very bounded period of time. And I would say that a lot of that sort of self-reflection on behalf of medicine takes place in the kind of 60s and 70s. There are, you know, almost radical movements within medicine that start to rethink the power structures, the emotional dynamics of healthcare, and to think much more critically about, you know, precisely that relationship that you mentioned between expertise and power, and between the doctor as the sort of dynamics between doctors and patients. And you have the emergence of something that is now very common, but was perhaps arguably more as a a sort of bit of a throwaway bit of terminology than an actual practice, but patient-centered care. That really emerges in the 1970s as a bit of language, as something that's supposed to be describing a new form of medicine. And you also have these, you know, as Lise was saying, these sorts of very sort of social science critiques of medicine that are being taken on board by at least some members of the medical profession, by people like Irvin Goffman and Ivan Illich, who are rethinking, you know, the sort of iatrogenic, the sort of harmful elements of medicine as much as the ways that it can help and ameliorate problems in society. But I would also agree with Lise. I think that there's a similar thing going on, which is not so much a shift in whether or not experts are taken seriously, but also a shift in the kind of expertise that is being used or deployed. And so in the case of patients, you know, there is a rise in sort of patient groups, of patient advocates, of people who share a particular diagnosis, for example, coming together to advocate for themselves, to sort of campaign against things in healthcare or healthcare policy that they think are harmful. You have, you know, the rise of sort of advocates for people with mental illnesses, people with chronic diseases, women's health, childbirth, all these sorts of issues become kind of increasingly politicized and increasingly sort of focused on the importance of taking patient experience as a form of expertise, not just as something, you know, that's nice to have, but as sort of a fundamental part of the decision-making process within healthcare practice and policy. But you then also see the rise of different kinds of expertise into the 1980s within healthcare. This is a kind of almost a trope, but, you know, it is true that you do have the rise of a kind of a managerialism, of a sort of expertise, a sort of the expert being a kind of new sort of management consultant. Different kinds of economic trends start being taken more seriously within healthcare policy and practice. And you do see a slight decline in the seriousness that is sort of attributed to, as, you know, Lise coins, the kind of more humanistic social sciences within medical decision making, within healthcare policy making. So I would say that medicine tracks a lot of the other areas that we're talking about, but it also has its own unique, well, perhaps not unique, but has its sort of own specialized problems of expertise, because it is always dealing with a relationship between two people, one of whom inhabits a body and one of whom is observing a body. And that throws up all of its own kinds of special questions around, you know, who knows best when you're talking about healthcare. And that's something that medicine, I think, still hasn't really resolved, despite having had several decades to think it through.
No, I think it's a really interesting framework. And as you both said, in a sense, perhaps the issue is less whether or not expertise is privileged, but what kinds of expertise are privileged at what particular moments. And I think, as you were just saying there, Agnes, you can't study the development of public services in the welfare state without giving attention to the way in which particular forms of expertise are given primacy at particular moments. And I think the rise of managerialism, the growth of the influence of management consultants is clearly a hugely important part of the evolution of the National Health Service over the last few decades. And indeed, some would also say the evolution of higher education and the modern university. Another focus in your work, Agnes, has been on women's experiences of the medical profession. And you recently co-authored what I thought was a hugely interesting article in the journal Renewal, headlined, "To Save the NHS, We Need to Stop Loving It." You argue that we should stop turning a blind eye to the failings of the current healthcare system and be willing to be more sceptical, acknowledging the limits of some of the way that NHS provision works. What is it about expertise that makes the current organisation of healthcare in the UK so unsatisfactory in your view?
Well, I think all these problems I've been talking about that have been recognised, worried about, thought through, you know, opined upon since at least the 1960s have really not been fixed. And I do think it's better to be a woman in the healthcare system today than it was in the 1960s. You know, I do think we've seen some progress, but I think that the way that knowledge is made within medicine and within the healthcare system, and what kind of knowledge is taken seriously and what kind of knowledge is valued, still to a large extent does a disservice to more marginalized members of our society. And that includes women, but it also includes other, you know, other groups that we could talk about. But I think that one of the things that has really, perhaps in some ways, clarified the problem, or if not exacerbated it, but given it a new configuration, and this is, I suppose, very relevant to our conversation more broadly, but the rise of evidence-based medicine and the randomized controlled trial, which ostensibly seem like very good things, and in lots of ways they absolutely are. You know, the sort of reliance on very specific and standardized ways of coming to, you know, the best possible diagnostic strategy, the best possible treatment options, the best possible ways of categorizing illnesses or ill health or conditions. You know, that has been routinized, specialized, professionalized, and invested with a lot more money since the 1980s. But one of the problems is that it has narrowed the space for experience within the healthcare system. And specifically when it comes to women, the medical profession remains male dominated, but even in fields of medicine, which have reached more or less gender equity, so in primary care, you still have a, I would say, largely traditional model of doctor as expert and patient as receiver of wisdom. You know, there is still, you know, despite the development of patient-centered care, patient-centered medicine, despite, you know, some very profound shifts in the way that both society as a whole, but also medicine specifically functions, you still have, I think, a hierarchy of power, of decision-making, of influence between doctor and patient. And for female patients, I think that's particularly profound, partly because there is a, you know, quite substantial dearth of the kinds of evidence that medicine takes seriously. There are very few women involved in randomized controlled trials, for example. Women's health is by and large underfunded, under-resourced, not a subject of primary interest for most large studies. And as a result, there is insufficient evidence that is the kind of evidence that doctors value on women. And so the kind of evidence that women can provide their doctors, which is the evidence of their own experience, is diminished or dismissed. And I think that, and this isn't a problem unique to the NHS, this is a problem of healthcare, of medicine, of westernized medicine. This is sort of a structure and sort of power dynamic, a kind of politic of medicine that, you know, extends well beyond the shores of the British Isles. But I do think that medicine hasn't really managed to reckon with this. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, we still have these very quantifiable problems with the way that women are treated by the healthcare system, the way women navigate their own healthcare concerns, how likely they are to receive diagnoses for very common complaints and illnesses like endometriosis. And all the same things could be said for people of colour, for people living with disabilities. It's also a problem that cuts across social class. And the NHS, I think, has been very protected from critique, partly because it has occupied this position. And it's particularly, I think, been protected from critique on the left, because it is held up as this, you know, incredibly valued part of not just left-wing politics and left-wing political achievement, but also of British national identity. And those sorts of commitments, those deeply felt emotional commitments, mean that some of the shortcomings of the healthcare system that are systemic and not individual aren't given quite the attention or kind of coverage that I think perhaps they need in order to be improved, or the sort of power dynamics to be shifted in a way that's productive.
No, indeed so. And it will be interesting to see whether the debate that ensues in the wake of COVID about the future of the NHS, whether it's possible or likely that any of those issues could actually be paid attention to, as it were, in thinking about how we can more sustainably provide healthcare in the future. Lisa, I want to turn to you. You've already mentioned Michael Young, and as a figure in the 20th century who raised doubts about the role of expertise in the welfare state, Michael Young was clearly a preeminent figure. Your book on Young's life draws attention to his role in forging closer links between government and the social sciences. But Young was also a strong advocate of drawing on the experiences of ordinary people in the development of social services in the welfare state. How, in your view, did Young square this circle between drawing on elite cadres of expertise in government and giving voice to the wisdom of families and communities in neighbourhoods?
It's a very good question. And in many ways, I'm not sure that he did. It's very interesting to listen to Agnes talk about, I suppose, the emphasis on patient-centered care and the critique of the sort of top-down managerialism of the NHS, which I think, which is in so many ways reminiscent of many of the critiques that social policy thinkers were making of the institutions of the welfare state in the 1950s and 60s. So the Institute of Community Studies is an organization which is set up in East London by Young. He moves from being the head of the Labour Party Research Department in the Attlee government to becoming a sociologist. And there, through his sociology, he effectively mounts a critique of many of the institutions that he himself had contributed to building, or that his party had contributed to building, particularly around housing policy and around the distribution of welfare. And pointing out that many of the policies that had been enacted by governments failed to recognize the ways in which people actually lived, failed to recognize their lived experience, and he's emphasizing the centrality of family networks and kinship structures to working class communities in East London, and argues that they're in many ways imposing quite managerial and top-down solutions, which are frustrating people and causing kind of the growth of antipathy towards the welfare state in itself. So in many ways, this is a sociological project to sort of try and rescue or improve the welfare state, but it has as its critique a sort of technocratic managerialism. And so there's lots of real resonances there with the work that Florence is continuing to do. And in many ways, I think we can see the post-war period as a whole as characterized by a kind of broad-based critique, which we might, I think, the historian Florence Sutcliffe Braithwaite has termed it a decline of deference. We could talk about other terms like popular individualism or desubordination. The idea that throughout this period, citizens have in many ways become very, have articulated different kinds of critiques of the state and the role of technocratic expertise within it. But returning to your question, returning to Young, in many ways, I'm not sure he ever really does square that circle, in that he consistently believes that by integrating sociological expertise into government, into policymaking, that will improve the kind of work that's done. And so, for example, he sets up the Social Science Research Council in the 1960s and under the Wilson government, seeks to deploy that as a kind of, in a sense, almost a think tank, a space for policymakers to engage with social science research and to work that out. And so I'm not sure that that's ever sort of really properly resolved. I mean, he, in his own case, turns very much to social innovation and social entrepreneurialism. And I think we have seen many kind of activists on the left deploy those perhaps less state-oriented organs as a way to perhaps get around some of the challenges of working within the state. But I think it's a tension that is ongoing for anyone who's interested in using expertise or using social scientific expertise to try and address policy questions. How do you avoid being top down? I'm not sure that we have an answer to that.
No, I think that's absolutely the case. And in your current work, you talk there about critiques of the state. You're, as you mentioned, researching the campaign for freedom of information. Mm. I wonder, how does the claim of expertise relate to ideas about transparency, accountability, openness, and forging a more engaged citizenry? How do those ideas relate to claims about the primacy of expertise?
I mean, it's such a big question, and it's very much the one that I'm grappling with right now. One of the terms that I'm really interested in is the concept of open government, which is something which I see appearing more and more from the 1960s onwards. And one of the things that I'm doing, and this is very much research in progress, is kind of, in a sense, trying to trace the relationship between calls for open government and government transparency in sort of left-wing or more progressive centrist circles in the late 1960s, which are very influenced by new left calls for kind of basically more individualist systems, more freedom in various realms of life. And thinking about the relationship between those campaigns for government openness and transparency in the 60s through to the eventual emergence of the Freedom of Information Act under the Blair government, which of course Blair then comes to bitterly regret as, and says was one of his greatest mistakes as prime minister, because he sees it as an act which is basically used as a kind of weapon by journalists rather than leading to better policymaking. But I'm very interested in tracing the kind of emergence of popular individualist calls for greater government transparency and seeing how those actually do feed into social democratic discourses through the 1980s and 90s and shape the politics of New Labour and beyond. But I do think that there are strands that we can trace from the 1960s and 70s that very much shape our politics today. So in a sense, I think one of the real themes of the post-war period is this call for openness and attack on what is seen as a sort of managerialist technocracy. But that's bound up with the professionalization of expertise through the expansion of universities and its role in integration into the policymaking process.
So we've, I think, had a really insightful tour through some of the ideas about expertise that have developed over the course of the post-war period and how those relate both to medicine and also more widely to the social sciences and the creation of the welfare state. I want to put a final question to both of you. It seems that in the wake of the COVID pandemic, people haven't necessarily had enough of experts. But what do you think the prospects for expertise are in the period ahead? And in particular, I want to ask you, for experts who are concerned about public and democratic engagement and their connection with citizens, how can experts of that kind think more imaginatively and constructively about how to sustain the legitimacy of expertise in increasingly polarized societies? It's a big question, I know. What are your thoughts, Agnes?
That is a big question.
It's a big question.
It is a very big question. I apologize. Well, what are your thoughts?
I'm very willing to give it a go. So I think one of the things, and I this is in some ways maybe a bit of an unfair request because I'm not 100% sure how it would actually play out and whether it would be successful or not. But I think one of the things as a historian of medicine and science, things that I've always found most frustrating about medicine and science, the things I study, is how unreflective sometimes some of its experts can be about their own expertise. And I think that this has seeped out into sort of public perceptions of medicine and science. And I think while it was begun as an effort to shore up the power and influence of scientific and medical experts, I think actually it is also the cause of its undoing. I've done a long lead in here, but basically I think that scientists and doctors, and not all of them, not all doctors, as I say often, that not all doctors, but many of them and many scientists present the kind of expertise that they provide, present the kind of knowledge that they have as infallible. This is sort of a special preserve of science and medicine that I think doesn't necessarily cross over to other academic or sort of expert disciplines. But there is a sort of sense that they make truth claims and that they are uniquely capable of understanding the world and the way that the world functions, and even things like how diseases function or viruses function. And I think that one of the problems is, and even the ones that don't present their work in this way often have their work presented in this way. And you mentioned right at the very beginning Boris Johnson's repeated insistence that he was simply following the science. And I think this encapsulates the problem like very well, and completely unintentionally on his part, I would say, that there is a sort of science out there that policymakers can follow is obviously absurd, right? That science gives us lots of different ways of interpreting, you know, knowledge around the world, about the world. Some of it is, you know, very well validated, but especially in the context of something like COVID, which was an emerging pandemic that nobody really had encountered before, there's a lot of unknowns, and science is doing the best it can, and I think, you know, is has to play a vital part in these decisions, in policy making. I'm not anti-science by any means, but I do think that both scientists themselves and the people who talk about science in the public sphere, whether that's politicians, whether that's journalists, whether that's anybody, I think would do better to be a bit more reflective, a bit more careful about the way that they frame what science can actually offer these conversations. I think a little bit more hubris. a little bit more humility, I suppose, really is what I mean, about what science can really tell us about how the world functions, and specifically with something like medicine and healthcare, which is, you know, vastly complex, and science can only really get us so far. I think having a little bit more, being a bit more circumspect about what science offers is very important. And obviously there are hazards here, right? Because you don't want that to then play into the hands of people who are keen on undermining the very sort of fundamental premise of what scientists say or can say. But I do think we could have a more sophisticated public discourse about the role of science in society and the power that science can wield in society and the harms that it can cause as much as the way it can help. And I don't know how to do this, but luckily I don't have to know how to do this because I'm just a historian and no one listens to me anyway. But I think that would be my kind of big statement, I suppose, in the kind of post-COVID world, or what, where to go with the future of expertise in the public sphere.
But I think that call for humility is very well made, and I think it will no doubt influence how different kinds of experts think about the post-COVID environment. Lise, what are your reflections on my impossibly broad question?
What it prompts for me is the problem about talking about expertise in general. So I think one of the important things to bear in mind when talking about expertise in the abstract is, of course, the many different forms of expertise and the many different ways in which they're deployed and either lionized or rejected by policymakers and by the public. So it strikes me as important to remember that, you know, whilst we did see to a certain degree the kind of, the lionization, we did see medical expertise given a certain profile during the COVID pandemic when there was a government priority to impose lockdowns and COVID regulations. You know, we see the expertise of other forms of experts like climate scientists routinely ignored if inconvenient. So I think it's important to not see there being a kind of straightforward relationship between expertise, authority, and policy. And similarly, I think we see enormous attacks on certain forms of expertise, for example, historical expertise, if it happens to be inconvenient to the government line, particularly around issues relating to decolonization or sort of racial and cultural justice. And so, for example, you know, we've seen a great deal of hostility from government itself towards historians who want to emphasize the, you know, Britain's historic crimes and the need for reparative justice around issues about decolonization or cultural policy or museums and so on and so forth. So I think it's important to, I guess, have a complex view of what expertise is. And I think talking about it too much in the abstract can sometimes be less constructive and can conflate really very different conversations. So that perhaps is again eliding your question, but I do think it's an important point to bring into to add to this conversation.
No, I agree. And I think that the conversation needs to go on about how you can try to create more constructive connections between those who inhabit worlds of expertise and those who see their knowledge as coming more from experiential communities or how individual lives are lived and so on. And I'm sure it will be a conversation that continues very much into the future. Thank you for listening. And thanks, of course, to Dr. Agnes Arnold-Forster and Dr. Lise Butler for joining us on today's podcast. You can access more from our excellent podcast series via the Mile End Institute website.